Coming up in this week in computer hardware, Coffee Lake, 6-core mobile CPUs, 2018 TV picks with Robert Hare, and new Mac Pros coming in 2019. Spectre V2 updates, and arc welding with a PC power supply. All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 460, recorded on April 5th, 2018. 12-core mobile CPUs. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/twit. Welcome to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show. The name is to bring you the most useful, most engageable, most delightful, most engageable. I'm actually already married. That could be problematic. But what isn't problematic is talking about hardware. And joining us today, as I try to salvage this terrible introduction, Mr. Robert Heron of HeronFidelity.com and, of course, AVXL.com, my partner in crime, talking home theater and audio. Mr. Heron, welcome to Twitch.
Hey, thank you, Patrick. I'm glad to be here, and it is a good day for all things home theater, in addition to, you know, the cool tech we get to talk about right now.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we should probably talk, since you're, conveniently, you're here, we're here, people like 4K TVs. 4K is the new 1080p. You can't buy a non-smart TV, but that's okay. Just ignore all of the smart stuff built into the television, unless you absolutely need it for some 4K HDR application. But I think the big exciting stuff, all the stuff we saw back at, not all of it, but almost all the stuff we saw back at CES in January is shipping. Or am I being too enthusiastic?
Some of it is. It is trickling out. We could say that for sure. Some of the models we previewed at CES are actually available for purchase today from the major manufacturers, be it like Sony, Samsung, and LG, or what I would put in the top tier of the TV manufacturers. Mm-hmm. We're still kind of waiting to see what Vizio is going to do for 2018. That's another one of those brands where it's good to keep an eye on it because they combine so much good technology at affordable prices. So, but for like in the last 48 hours, I've seen LG's latest 2018 televisions, in particular, the OLED panels everyone seems to like, actually pop up on Amazon and others for actual purchase. So if you wanted one of these in your home today, you could jump on it and do it. Probably at relatively at the maximum end of pricing, so to speak, but it's available and they're trickling out. I'm still awaiting some of the flagship models from all the manufacturers to come out. I don't think anybody has actually dropped their very best for the year yet. So if you're looking for the absolute best LCD or the absolute best OLED panel out there, give it a few more weeks and we'll see. But
well, we were talking about on AVXL, you were circling LG's B7, which is kind of their entry-level 2017 OLED, which is fine because in 2017, LG was offering the same processing and the same glass pretty much on all of their OLED panels. Is there a huge difference in performance between the 2017 and 2018 models?
The difference will come down to video processing more than anything. As you're looking at right there, that's the new C8 panel for 2018. And effectively, you're going to have very similar color characteristics and absolute brightness compared to what the 2017 models were doing. What that particular model that you're looking at right there will offer, starting with the C series on up, will be improved video processing. Significantly improve video processing. I would hearken to say that they paid attention carefully to what Sony did last year with that A1E panel, which is also based upon LG's OLED tech, but Sony ended up actually incorporating advanced video processing features into their sets last year in a mostly successful fashion that brought along features and abilities that we were kind of missing as far as what LG was doing. And so for 2018, LG has really stepped up with this, what they call their Alpha 9 processor. And it incorporates not only improve things related to either compressed video or less than ideal video sources, be it your streaming content or maybe old school DVDs being upconverted and displayed in 4K, to some really interesting calibration features as well that can make these absolutely reference quality displays that are increasingly being used in professional environments. These consumer grade TVs can be configured in such a way that they act and function for all intents and purposes as a pro monitor. And I'm seeing that across the board. And that's one of the things now built into the 2018 sets, at least from the C series on up. Actually, for the B series, we'll have most of these same features too, but with a few exceptions. But that's really the big deal for what LG is doing in particular. For Samsung, on the other hand, oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to ask if does OLED or do LG's OLEDs and Sony's LG OLEDs with Sony processing, do they still have a performance advantage in terms of visual quality over Samsung's LCD panels?
They will, almost in all cases, you could say that, because with OLED panels being an emissive display and the ability to be able to turn individual pixels completely off with no light output, that inherently opens up a few performance advantages over pretty much LCD technology in general. Specifically, when you get off axis a little bit, even a little bit with an LCD, your contrast and your color start to tank, to put it mildly. And that's one of the benefits. So if you're looking at, say, a high dynamic range picture on your 4K TV and you're not seated in that sweet spot, which I'll be honest with you, few people seem to be there unless you purposely set it up that way. But people tend to spread themselves out in rooms. And if you're not dead on with most LCDs, they're not going to look their absolute best. And that's one area where OLED panels, and even going back to like plasmas for the most part, they were able to provide a more consistent picture from no matter where you were in the room. And when you talk about high dynamic range in particular, especially think of like an outer space scene where it's a really dark background with maybe a really bright object in the foreground. Mm-hmm. On most LCDs, you'll have some blooming or halo artifacts around that object because the granularity of the backlight system and its ability to control light bleed and spread from that bright object just isn't as fine as you get with OLED panels that can literally shut off the pixel completely with no light transmitting through it or out. And the contrast is something to behold. However, we have seen demonstrations of what Samsung has planned for their premium flagship models. And subjectively, in a canned test environment, I will say that it was as impressive looking as it approached an OLED as close as I've seen any LCD to date, with about three times the light output. So given Samsung's historic color quality advantages in terms of being able to produce a bright picture with a greatly saturated color palette and a wide color palette, OLED panels, on the other hand, are going to be able to match that, I think, the color saturation, but you're still kind of limited in terms of the absolute light output. But in a darkroom environment or even a dimly lit environment, it's a fantastic display to look at. It's just it's something that's always pleasing with a wide variety of different content types. And this is going to be an interesting year all around.
In terms of the big winner for the most affordable, or what the Wirecutter would call the best 4K UHD HDR television for everyone, HTC certainly pretty much had everybody's pick last year, not just the Wirecutters, including ours on AVXL. Is HTC going to be delivering another model like that? We were hoping they would deliver sort of similar quality and more sizes this year. Are those showing up yet?
Maybe not the phone manufacturer, but TCL and that P-Series.
I'm going to hang my head in shame now.
It's okay.
Hey, TCL, there are plenty of models HTC, out there. Oppo Digital, Sony, LG Sound. Let me see if I can insult everyone.
No, don't. Please. Yeah, but TCL kind of snuck up on everyone by providing an LCD panel with full array local dimming, which provides improved contrast over most edge-lit systems. There is an exception I could think of off the top of my head. But anyway, they were delivering a 55-inch panel for about $600. That was the equivalent of just about any other LCD out there in terms of light output, color quality, and supporting the major HDR formats, namely HDR 10 and Dolby Vision. So having all of that in one TV built upon the Roku platform just made it like a solid go-to buy at a good price point. And for this year, they're introducing their 6 series coming out, I believe, May 1st. I am really looking forward to seeing what they're going to do as far as that panel goes. When we previewed it at CES again, it was looking to be a cosmetic upgrade at first, where it looks more quality, or it looks like a higher end unit with its styling and trim and everything like that. However, they will be adding more zones of local dimming for even a more granular ability to control the contrast and light output across the whole screen to make it look more OLED-like. And I'm sure it's going to have a terrific amount of light output as well, being a full array local dimming TV with that LED array behind that screen, being able to drive a lot of light into the picture. I'll be curious to see how it compares to like what Samsung does with their anti-reflective and anti-glare coatings. Samsung has some of the best in the world right now in terms of what they're able to put on the very surface of their TVs to minimize room light reflections and other things that can really degrade image quality regardless of what kind of picture you have. Yeah, that's their flagship for this year. And I think that is that the F9? It is. Oh, it's available now. Well, forgive
me.
Surprise! Ta-da! Not cheap, but, you know, if that's even close to the demo I saw at CES, that was the LCD that was as close to being OLED-like as I have seen from any panel, including superb off-axis viewing and a host of other tricks that they've employed to make just one fantastic-looking display. And also, in terms of ease of setup and general usability, that's something Samsung's been working very hard at as well. In terms of making the TV literally, no matter what you plug into it, it has a good database of what all these devices are and to help you configure things automatically to get the best performance out of it, be it a variety of cable boxes down to the individual providers, to all the latest game consoles and other devices. They've really gone out of their way to test as many of these as possible so that when you plug it in, the TV knows what it is and is able to configure it appropriately.
That's a plus.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. I wanted to pick your brains about something else. We were chatting earlier. You function as the sysadmin for an organization that, amongst other things, has about 3,000 1080p video cameras arrayed in a pretty sophisticated network. You told me you put a new camera in, and, you know, we joke about the Internet of Things and the attacks. But what happened within the first sort of 5 or 10 minutes when you plugged that latest camera into the system?
Well, it wasn't so much the camera, although it may have been related to that. But the software that I use to drive the camera system on the back end, it is exposed to the internet, so people can remotely log into it, authorize users and things like that. However, within the configuration software itself, it actually has a setup for, hey, if somebody tries to log in X number of times over X number or Y number of minutes and it exceeds those parameters, you can then log that IP address and automatically block it. And I guarantee you, anything that's touching the internet at some point is being scanned and probed to see if it's all set up by default or not. And in this case, right. I had a nice little, I think it was just a system message built into the system. It basically informed me of the IP address of someone who was just blocked. I went ahead and did the geolocation, I guess, of that IP address. That, of course, can be spoofed, but it did point to somebody in the Russian, in the middle of nowhere Russia, basically, who was probing our camera system just to see if they could get in or not. And I was thankful, at least, that they tried a bunch of passwords really fast and then got blocked. So
that's good.
For any device that you're connecting to the internet, especially things that incorporate video and audio recording or personal data touching the web in some way, you want to make sure you've gone through and not only changed all the default passwords, but take a look at some of those options related to login attempts and other security measures and configure appropriately. And if you can, even isolate it further. For the camera systems I deal with, I won't use wireless anything. So it's all hardwired to a dedicated, separated network. And then in this case, we did have to allow some remote access for people to, you know, look at the video streams on their phones and things like that. But you lock it down as much as possible. And that to me was kind of interesting. And it's good to see that the software apparently works. It's not foolproof, but at least it's better than leaving, you know, admin 1234, you know, those kind of default logins that everyone knows. And people are actively looking for devices like that to take over. And in the worst case scenarios, install custom firmware into these devices to turn them into, you know, the greatest botnet ever or whatever. Right. You know, there's so many of those cases and scenarios out there right now that are happening today that it's definitely something to keep your eye on, so to speak.
Be a good citizen of the interwebs. Lock down your gear, people. Crazy news this week. Apple leaving Intel.
Well, good luck with that.
By 2020. That's the goal. You know, according to Bloomberg, Apple plans to abandon Intel chips as early as 2020, bringing Apple's own A-series processors to Mac hardware. I think it's kind of fascinating, the idea that Apple is actually thinking about trying to pull their own processor lineup into the OS X world.
I think for mobile devices, it's like a why not?
Yeah.
Is anyone using an Intel chip as the primary CPU in any mobile device? Not that I'm aware of.
Well, depends on that. You can say a laptop a mobile device.
No, it's mobile devices, like the things you hold in your hand, the most popular on the planet. So when it comes to that, and if you're already doing, say, ARM designs and licensing their technology, the question would be then, are you still paying ARM for licensing their technology and building chips based upon their tech? Or are you going with something even more open or less restrictive? But
I think at this point, I don't know. I mean, you know, Apple has bought entire companies to gain technology to improve ARM performance for their own proprietary Apple processors. And one of the things it's the idea is that, you know, iPad and Mac apps are eventually going to merge into sort of one giant software platform.
There is that one technology called RISC or RASC, and then there's RASC-V.
Well,
and that apparently is an open instruction set, and you could actually build something that doesn't require at least licensing technology from ARM, so to speak. But I'd be curious to see if Apple's considering that or just stick with what you know and get it right.
I think Apple's assuming they're going to get so much performance out of the ARM platform in a couple more years that they can replace them on the low end. I'm also laughing because, you know, RISC versus CISC was the big, you know, part of the big Windows versus Mac argument system 20 years ago.
So, but I was like, does anyone have like an open platform like that to build these custom chips if you wanted to? And I was surprised to realize that there, if you do a Google search for something called RASC-V or just RISC-V or RISC-5, I'm not sure what the V part stands for, but you'll go down a rabbit hole pretty quick of a quote unquote open architecture for, you know, the instructions and everything you would need to build a chip without right. it being beholden to anyone, so to speak. And considering it was designed by our good friends over in Berkeley, the University of California at Berkeley, just something gives it a little local flavor that I appreciate it too. So
I now up at riskv.org, and I've discovered that RISC-V is pronounced RISC-5, the free and open ISA enabling a new era of processor innovation through open standard collaboration. Founded in 2015, the RISC-V Foundation comprises more than 100 members, including the first open collaborative community of software and hardware innovators powering innovation at the edge forward. Born in academia and research, and it's basically they're trying to say they're laying down the platform for, quote, the next 50 years of computing design and innovation. I'll be very curious to see where it goes. And it's also kind of
wild, honest, though. But when it comes to notebooks and things like that, I am completely satisfied with what I get out of my Intel-based hardware on a mobile platform like that. And, you know, that to me is, I think, not necessarily a tougher thing to challenge Intel on, but it's more in their wheelhouse in terms of what they do really, really well in terms of creating a unified, be it a system on a chip for your wireless and networking, in the same notebook with their CPU and their motherboard designs. And I mean, they make some fantastic hardware on that level, but when it gets into the handheld devices, that's where That's where I think Apple could really innovate and come up with their own hardware for that.
Well, they certainly have already come up with that, right? There's custom processors going into, you know, the iPhones that, you know what I mean,
that's true.
They have done a pretty good job of creating custom silicon and then modifying the silicon to improve parts of the operating system or the functioning of the cameras especially. I think what they're thinking here is that they're going to, you know, I think they're going to smersh together OS X and iOS, or at least the application, so they'll move back and forth. And then I think they want to be able to have the same level of customization in the processors. The stuff they can't do with Intel, but they can do with their own processors. I think they want to bring that to more models in the lineup. I'll be curious to see if that ends up being true. Because one of the other things that came out this week is that there are not going to be any new iMac Pros until 2019. But apparently, a TechCrunch writer sat down with Apple about a year ago and found out that Apple's actually going to talk to users and study workflow before designing the next generation of professional Macintoshes. Because oddly enough, they did something that was incredibly aesthetically appealing, but made life incredibly difficult for a lot of professionals that were on OS X and using Mac Pros. So it's an interesting article up in TechCrunch. Apple's 2019 Mac Pro will be shaped by workflows, which I think is a really awesome way of Apple saying, you know, we're going to talk to the people who actually buy our products, and we're going to look at how people use our products before we decide to create a giant tube that you will connect 29 different cables to replace the large silver box that used to be sitting under your desk.
Seriously, but know your customer.
Yeah. You know, it sounds crazy, but it's legit. The other thing I thought was interesting coming out of Apple Land, another Bloomberg article, was that Apple's apparently working on touchless control and a curved iPhone screen. It wouldn't be the first curved iPhone screen we saw. Of course, LG did a curved Android phone several years ago. I would be very curious to see how that gets implemented, because apparently they're going to sort of curve it more, or maybe put sort of a Bezier French curve on there, which is something we haven't seen before. But I'd be very curious to see how that works out. And also, apparently, the OLED screen from the iPhone X is going to be showing up in additional models. Ask us more in June when Apple does their big reveal of the next generation models.
I'll be curious to see what kind of curve they're actually talking about, whether it's like a one-dimensional curve, like where you just have a nice, I don't know, like almost a banana to it if you wanted a phone that shape. Or are they looking at something more like the Samsung Edge designs, where you have the edges that do that nice roll-off on each side like that? I guess we'll see. But it seems unlikely that they're going with anyone else besides Samsung for the time being for their displays, despite all of the news items that have dropped throughout the last few months related to Apple exploring other display technologies, be it micro LED or others. That's probably the only thing that's really going to try to challenge what OLED's doing as far as a handheld display goes. And it's my absolute favorite handheld display. I dread the day I have to go back to an LCD-based cell phone, but, you know, I guess time will tell.
According to Bloomberg, quote, Apple is also developing iPhone displays that curve inward gradually from top to bottom.
Yeah.
Different banana. From the latest Samsung. Yeah, instead of the Samsung smartphone screens, which curve down at the edges. So,
trying to recreate, I guess, a classic look, and then it becomes more about usability. You can't curve it too much, otherwise it becomes a little unwieldy in terms of using your thumbs and fingers on the touchscreen display itself. But if it requires not touching it at all, where you can just do gestures in front of your phone, I personally have no desire for that whatsoever, unless it works damn well, or it's practically mind reading me at that point. But we'll see. You know, I love
where's
to hear
your
these.
Sense of adventure.
A little practical. I just want it to work really, really well.
That would be good. You know what else should work really, 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 really well? Applying for a mortgage, which generally is a painful, atrocious, awful experience, which is why, well, let me point out, this episode, This Week in Computer Hardware, brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Mortgage experience, it just wasn't keeping up with the times. Dated. It's about the bank, not about you. It was about The client was kind of lost in the shuffle. The technology was an afterthought, if it even felt like it was there at all, which is why Quicken created Rocket Mortgage. It gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's really simple. The idea is that they want you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you, which if you've ever dealt with a mortgage broker, might not be your experience. And I like the idea that they want you to know what's going on and know what you're getting into, which is exactly the opposite of the experience a lot of people have had. It's convenient. You know, Rocket Mortgage trusted partners allow you to share your financial information at the touch of a button. And it's powerful. It doesn't matter if it's your first home or your 10th home. Rocket Mortgage can run thousands of calculations in seconds. You make a tweak, it does the math. You know what kind of situation you get yourself into. It's really cool. Based on your income, your assets, your credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all the home loan options for which you qualify and find the one that's just right for you. Get the right loan, people. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/twit. That's rocketmortgage.com/twit. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support. Oh, my goodness. New processors from Intel. And Intel has unveiled more. They've slowly are trickling out 8th generation processors. And the big one, of course, that just came out this week, Coffee Lake H, 6-core mobile CPUs. These are high-performance mobile processors. Optane memory caching has been brought to mobile for the first time. The processors in these are pretty awesome. The top-of-the-line processor, 6-core, 12 threads. And what they're calling Intel Velocity Boost, which is kind of a super single-core TrueBar boost that'll run it up to 4.8 gigahertz max, up from like 4.6. That's the Core i9-8950HK. These are pretty manageable, 45-watt parts. And that Core i9-8950HK is actually unlocked, which is kind of crazy. They'll all pretty much handle two channels of DDR4 2666, although they have a couple of options that also do ECC RAM, if you're essentially Xeon processors. And they're running from the Intel Core i5-8300H, which is running at 4 gigahertz, 4 cores, 8 threads, maxing out at that Intel Core i9-8950HK, which the base clock speed on that is 2.9 gigahertz. And they can max it out for a single core at 4.8 gigahertz, and that's 6 cores and 12 threads on that one. The chipsets on these are really cool. The 300 series mobile chipsets that were announced, USB 3.1 Gen 2 ports directly from the chipsets. They've integrated an 802.11ac radio into the chipset, so look for phenomenal performance off of those if you are moving all the bits and all the data. And a few more U processors in the lineup too, running from the Core i3-8109U, which is a 3 gigahertz base clock speed, 3.6 gigahertz maxed out, 2-core, 4-thread processor, and then a couple of i5 processors running at 3.8 and 4.2 gigahertz in turbo mode, and then the Intel Core i7-8559U, which its base clock speed is 2.7 gigahertz. Turbo boost will hit a single core up to 4.5 gigahertz, and all those Core i5s and Core i7s, 4 cores, 8 threads, and 28 watts on the TDP. So, and they all offer Intel Optane memory support.
That unlocked i9 has me just going, For the most of the applications I play with, though, in particular, my gaming habit, I'm finding that my GPU gets maxed out more frequently than I find my CPU getting maxed out. So I would like to know what kind of performance benefit I would get in a gaming environment with something like the latest unlocked i9. Compared to, say, what I'm running currently with my current graphics card. And that's without actually putting it all together, it's kind of hard to know one way or another. It's hard to just say, would it be worth it? Would I really get a significant frame rate boost, say, making that leap? So
just need to find somebody with the same GPUs or similar GPUs with both your processor and that Core i9. Most of these Core i9s are going to be showing up on
high-end gaming laptops, at least the ones we're going to see first. The Verge has a nice roundup of that. Acer's got the Nitro 5. You'll notice a lot of these are very large 15-inch laptops with very loud keyboards. The first one up there is the Acer Nitro 5. If you scroll down a little bit on there, the Gigabyte Aero 15 and 15X, which is crazy, right? Because it's a laptop with a 144-hertz refresh rate on that Gigabyte Aero. The Samsung Notebook Odyssey Z, that'll support 16 gigabytes of RAM, 1 terabyte of NVMe PCI storage, which isn't that unusual. And it's just a regular 15.6-inch 1080p display. Although the having a late model 1060 on that is a nice touch. Asus ROG Zephyrus M. And you keep going, the Asus ROG G703. If you want to spend all the money on a laptop, you can do it, although it's kind of impressive. Because right now, I mean, it's funny because GPU prices are coming down. We should probably mention that. But I'm looking at this, you know, like a 120-hertz display, a GTX 1060 at like $1,500 in a high-performance gaming laptop. That's a pretty good deal. So,
damn.
Yeah, and, you know, I was talking about it on Tech Thing this week. GPU prices are still almost 2x MSRP, but there are a lot, especially if you go over to Newegg, there are a ton of GPUs shipping right now, and you're looking at like 3 gigabyte 1060 starting at around $290, 6 gigabyte card starting at somewhere between $330, $350 for GTX 1060. Of course, 1070s and 1080s are available.
Checkbook. I was looking for a 1080 Ti, and that was $1,500. Couple days ago. So that's, most people aren't spending that much on the whole rig, let alone just the graphics card. So,
well, I agree. But I mean, if you take a look at these numbers in here, right, you know, that's $679 down from a peak of probably $1,400.
Exactly. It was outrageous just in terms of, with the cryptocurrency mining and a variety of other items too that probably contributed to the prices getting jacked up the way they were. But I also realized that my last video card upgrade was related to the release of Far Cry 4. And now that Far Cry 5 is out, I'm finding that it runs really well on my 1060 with 6 gigabytes. But I'm wondering if how much better would it be with a 1080? But there's no way I'm spending $1,500 on a graphics card in my current rig. I'd have to be building a whole brand new system for that.
Yeah. What's your monitor size? What's your resolution on your monitor?
Yeah. See, I'm also running it like 1920 by 1200 and what else? Yeah. So I can run everything
at
Ultra.
1060 for you.
Well, I can run everything at Ultra at a solid 60 frames a second. So I definitely need a monitor upgrade first before I go crazy on the graphics card side of bumping that up a little bit further. But I'm super happy. I'm actually happy with how well the system performs with some of the latest AAA titles coming out. As far as PC gaming goes, I'm getting plenty of frame rate in terms of having that visual quality where I want it, which is generally, I hate turning things down. I'd rather leave all the pretty features on. But if I can't maintain a smooth flow of frame rate through, especially first-person shooter games and other games that just they feel and play so much better when the frame rate's solid and stable. That's what's most important to me. And yeah, there we go. send my pet dog at the enemy. I'm having a hard time staying on track with the storyline in the Far Cry 5. It's more or less every time I come across the new vehicle, especially the flying vehicles, I'll just start tooling around.
Get crazy.
Let's go explore the environment until I'm either shot out of the sky or chased down by the hordes of the cult members or whatever. So I'm actually enjoying that game quite a bit. And it has a fantastic audio soundtrack as well. That still continues to impress me. Like if somebody told me 5 or 10 years ago how the video game industry would be on par or exceeding what Hollywood does in terms of money generated and how much you can get in the first 3 days of a title being released compared to, say, box office receipts and things like that. Video games are here, and they are probably one of the most powerful forms of entertainment in terms of as a business we have on this planet. And with titles like that, although I will say, I bought Far Cry 5, the pre-ordered it before it came out, and I know better than to be doing that, because you will always find glitches and bugs and little things that just kind of take you out of the moment. And Far Cry 5 is no exception. It will be a better game in a month or so when they get the first couple of patches out. So
right,
that's if I have one regret, it's that. But otherwise, I'm loving it. It's a fun environment and a kind of a creepy, cool story. And I'm looking forward to the end, trying to see the end before I read a spoiler accidentally or something like that. So
game quickly. Something that might finally have you upgrading your desktop or your devices around the house, your older PCs around the house. Good short write-up up on PC Per. Quotes, have an old Intel CPU and worried about Spectre V2. We predict your taste will branch out soon, which is Jeremy Hellstrom's way of saying Intel's not going to provide Spectre V2 patches for a whole bunch of models. There's a really deep write-up on the Inquirer, but it comes down to, if you want to dig into the microcode update guidance dated April 2nd, 2018. And it basically talks about, it's an Intel PDF that lists what's going on in terms of the microcode updates that will repair the flaws. And first of all of the processors on the list that might not be getting a Spectre V2 fix should all have of the first variation of Spectre and Meltdown should both be patched and good to go. But quote, it would seem, writes Jeremy Hellstrom, that over 230 models dating back to 2011, which are still vulnerable to Spectre V2, will remain so indefinitely, as fixing the issue is both incredibly complex and not economically beneficial to Intel. If you have an old – one of the things Intel said is they talked to a lot of their partners. In some cases, they found out a lot of these processors, especially things like older Atom processors, are essentially built into devices that have very limited opportunity to be connected to the net or fairly secured. Again, all of the latest generation processors coming out now are supposed to be coming from the factory without the vulnerabilities, or the vulnerabilities have already been blocked. And if you want to get really geeky and start reading about lots of processors most people have forgotten about a long time ago. Oh, look, Kaby Lake, Nathalem, Penryn V2 has been stopped on the development. It's kind of a long trip down memory lane.
Intel's introduced new vulnerabilities that they are completely unaware of, like the last time around. So
truly secure. But I mean, I'm looking at some of the ones that have been stopped, like Yorkfield Xeon, Wolfdale. I mean, these are going back in some cases.
True, but you think about, especially on the server side of things, where you mm-hmm. have lots of CPUs being deployed at once, those aren't necessarily upgraded as frequently as some of the, maybe like a hardcore gamer would be upgrading their CPU in a home environment or those kind of scenarios. I picture that there will be vulnerable CPUs out there for the rest of our lives, or at least.
You mean like unpatched Windows XP boxes?
Yeah, exactly. Like every other. Vulnerable routers. I'm shocked at what still runs XP nowadays, but it's all there to be hacked.
Yeah, sometimes don't look too close. You might get really, really terrified. A couple more thoughts before we go. HTC Vive Pro starter kit. They've dropped the price. So everybody's excited about the HTC Vive Pro. Shannon got eyeballs on or head inside of the HTC Vive Pro. Was really excited for the upgraded resolution on the monitors inside of that. And of course the it fits the head. It fits much better. But what was painful about that was $800 without any accessories. So you essentially had to own an existing Vive and then port your accessories over. They've cut, $100 off the price of the accessories. So now you can get a full HTC Vive Pro starter kit for $1,100, which means, there's something painful with the idea of buying an $800 box and getting home and discovering that you can't use it until you buy several hundred dollars more in accessories. But again, the HTC Vive at a discount right now. And Ars Technica did a nice write-up taking a look at HTC Vive Pro performance on 1070 and 1060 GTX cards, and or I should say GTX 1060 and 1070s, found that it ran okay. Performance on a 1060 was good, acceptable, not emotionally traumatizing. So good to know.
Good to know.
So several weeks ago, Alan and I saw a Kickstarter for Nude CNC's frameless water block, and we couldn't decide if it was it's the Encore V1, and we couldn't decide if it was. We thought, "See, this is a joke. Is this for real?" And I got a very lovely tweet. It was basically, "Dude, it's real, and it's beautiful." I got to say, it is a naked dye cooling water block designed by Nude CNC. And they've got 25 days to go, 45 backers, $5,836 pledged towards a $14,080 goal. And it is a pretty amazing, pretty nice piece of machining on there. And, you know, the idea is that if you've popped the heat spreader off, you can cool the dye, and it gets held down in
That's
the
hardcore, man.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty.
This is for a system that's delidded the CPU.
That's my understanding.
God damn.
Yeah.
That's getting serious about your cooling at that point. I'm impressed.
I am impressed too. Hey,
I like that. Like a happy camper right there.
Let's see. Pledge 69. For some reason, I'm in the British site, of course, because getting on the. About 96, 69 pledge. Let's see, pledge $49 US, and you get a delidding tool with the Encore V1 and V1D digital package. For $97, you will get the Encore V1 early bird version with instructions available by scanning QR code. And I've just managed to open up every single web page on my system simultaneously. $111 gets you the Encore V1 Kickstarter special, which includes a photo book, and it goes on and on and on. So estimated delivery on these are pretty much August 2018, unless you just buy the £25 or $35 photo book with exclusive project updates that will deliver in June 2018. So
very cool.
Yeah.
Well, I'm literally and figuratively.
Literally and figuratively. Yeah, it's about $97 to get an actual Encore.
I was unaware that extreme water cooling setups would actually go ahead and delid a CPU at this point. I didn't know anybody was doing that. Apparently, they are.
Maybe I'm reading it wrong.
No, I don't think you are.
Yet Core V1 includes a delidder to delid the CPU.
That's taking it to the next level.
I think it's awesome.
Cooling needs. What the hell? Why not?
I'm probably not going to bring one home because children and stuff, but it's pretty. So, just so you know, Encore V1 naked dye cooling water block, good to go.
Very nice, man.
It still terrifies me, and I swear this is not. I can't decide. You know what? I meant to ask Ryan, but. I meant to ask Ryan if this was an April Fool's joke or not, but there's so much detail on this. It's either the best April Fool's joke ever, or it's not actually a...
Well, I am ashamed to admit that I spent quite a bit of time looking at what... I didn't realize it until about three quarters of the way through an article that I was entranced with about some next-gen NVIDIA GPU.
Right.
And then I realized you get about three quarters. The article was written really well, and it would look legit until you get about three quarters of the way through, and they started making some statements and things that were just like, wait a minute, what day is it today? And I'm like, ah, damn it. I was laughing. It was suddenly like, this new GPU has 10 times the amount of compute units and blah, 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 blah. Anyway, I got sucked in by at least one article over that great holiday. It also amazed me. In some of the news feeds from like Google and other people, how many April Fool's stories would pop up there as like legit news? And I'm like, okay, if Google can't filter this crap out, then we're all pretty doomed at this point. Well,
then there's Elon Musk who accidentally vaporized a bunch of shareholder value with his April Fool's Day Twitter humor. But what's kind of crazy about this, right? This is Lee Garbutt, who does all the reviews of power supplies for PC Per, took a Corsair AX1600i, bolted. Keep scroll down a little bit, right? This is a ridiculously powerful there is, stop, scroll up a little bit. You know, there's something like 133 amps it can deliver maxed out. And it's pretty crazy. So he took all of the available power output from the AX1600i and stick welded with it. Now, I thought it was, you know, he bolted on a higher capacity fan. You know, he had to get all of the leads together, bundle all the 12 volt cables into the welding leads. You know, it's, and the hardest part, he said, was actually trying to strike and maintain an arc with only 12 volts, which is a little bit lower than you would normally have. Normally, you would bundle a bunch of like 12 volt car batteries together, do an emergency stick welder running at like 36 volts. But he had to disable the safety protection. About this point is when I realized, if you keep scrolling down, I realized that he'd actually done this. He disabled the safety protection circuit chip on the digital control board, tweaked the software, and apparently actually managed to weld some steel with a power supply, with a PC power supply. So that fan is not normally on an AX1600i. He put that to boost the cooling inside of there.
You know, that's some dedication right there. Considering, well, I think you could buy a stick welder on Amazon for like $130-140. Yeah. I don't, it's probably not the greatest stick welder ever, but it's a stick welder. So
he points it out. You can buy one for considerably less money and considerably less time. If you just want to weld some stuff together. I was reading this and I'm like, oh my goodness, he actually did this. Lee does amazing work reviewing power supplies for PC Perspective. So I thought this was a hoot and wanted to point that out.
That's pretty cool.
So you and I host AVXL.com. We'll probably be talking about headphones next week after I get back from Kansas this weekend.
I saw some particularly interesting projectors this week too. I'm finally seeing projectors, eyeballs and equipment on projectors that can actually do over about 95% of DCI color space. And that was something I was hoping to see sooner than later. And I'm glad to say there are such beasts out there. And it's that combo of that wide color palette plus 4K resolution that gets to be expensive very quickly. And we'll get into that in a little bit. I also saw JVC, of all people, has a new value projector we should probably mention as well.
Really?
There's just a lot of cool little projector stuff happening right now.
They define JVC's value.
$2,500, but it's a true 4K and it's DLP instead of their DILA, their liquid crystalline silicon technology. So that was just,
will that support HDR?
Yes, except it as far as all the specs I can find on it, it has Rec 709 color, but it should be able to support high dynamic range. It definitely will accept it as an input, and then it depending on how it's set up, it will then display it appropriately. You're so limited with the brightness output or the light output of a DLP projector or projectors in general. And the one thing that JVC had going for it and still does is the fact that they have some of the best contrast ratios of any projector manufacturer out there. In terms of black level is some of the darkest you will see. I can't think of another projector brand off the top of my head in consumer space that offers the just that solid contrast performance. And that's most of the way getting you there in terms of appreciating a high dynamic range viewing experience. So if they could just simply marry that up with some exquisite DCI and beyond color, it's going to be pretty fantastic. So we'll dig into that a little bit, but I also had a chance to that I think lists for $2,500. I had some hands-on time with a brand new projector of theirs. It's about twice as much that did true DCI color and their E-Shift 4K technology, their latest generation of that. Overall, a very, very impressive beast of a projector. And nice. It also had some really interesting features for people interested in widescreen projection, like 22x9 or your cinema 235:1 or 240:1 screen sizes without resorting to masking systems. This actually had it integrated in. And I didn't know that was happening already, but the projector itself could actually do some masking internally to help mitigate the issues. I thought that was pretty cool. Combine that with some memory presets and things like that for the lens setup. And you could quickly switch between different types of content, be it your 16x9 video and your 235:1 or beyond video. So there's a lot of goodness going there. That's somebody awesome. Else also asked too if Samsung's still doing curved screens. Yes, they are. If at least, but not for the 9 series, but going to like the 8, 7, and probably 6. Maybe not the 6, but keep an eye out if it has a F or a C after the number 9. And that will tell you if it's going to be a flat or a curved screen. That's a quickie right there. They're offering them either way. So nice. LG is sticking to all flat screens. And I don't know if any of the other big manufacturers in North America are doing curved screens. I don't think so. But I could be
wrong. Yeah. We'll find out. A lot of 2018 left. Something else coming up on AVXL. If you're into subwoofers, we're going to have Brent Butterworth up in the next week or two, or not up, on. We're going to Skype him into a conversation to tap into his extraordinary knowledge of subwoofers. And again, I'll be down at Can Jam this weekend doing a hangout on Saturday night in downtown Los Angeles if you want to come hang out. And if you can and you're in Southern California, you should drive up to LA and come listen to all the amazing headphones. If you're curious, AVXL this week, AVXL tech thing this week, we had a long conversation about Cloudflare 1.1.1.DNS, their security and privacy efforts that they're working on, what they're doing now, and whether or not it'll actually speed up your performance. We talked about VPN, what you need to look for, because we constantly get asked, which VPN, should I buy this VPN? There's a deal on this VPN. And a really fun conversation about used mining GPUs and if it was okay to buy them. And boy, that turned into a revealing conversation and me getting incredibly deep in an IEEE article about transistors wearing out, which is something you're probably not going to run into because almost everything else on the board that the transistors are attached to will probably explode first. But that doesn't mean you should be buying used GPUs. And it was good. Oh, and one more triple driver over-ear headphones. Got a review of those in there. And I'm going to stop talking about tech thing because we are right here on Twitch this week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that brings you all the hardware news. You can find all of our older episodes and information on how to subscribe at twit.tv/twitch. And Ryan Schrott, I believe, will be back. He is at a special meeting in New York City right now that I cannot disclose, but hint, it's about a big, bad desktop processor that's coming in the near future. And, of course, you can catch Mr. Robert Heron with me at AVXL. And what's that website, Robert?
AVXL.com and HeronFidelity.com. Well, I need
that's
to really
the one. Heron Fidelity. Get the shot collar.
hell yeah. Actually, I need to redo my theme for that website and probably just update it. It's not as mobile friendly as I would like it to be, and I need to work on that. So, the world's gone mobile.
Oh, yes, and constantly. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening to this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm Patrick Norton.
Hey, I am Robert Heron.
See you next week on Twitch.